Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Larry Sampler, Assistant to the Administrator and Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID. So, Larry, I talk to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnership among agencies and with the private sector to achieve mission results. Would you tell us how you're leveraging partnerships to improve outcomes and operations?
Yeah, this is one of the things that I enjoy the most about my work. Coming from a military environment, I was in a particular military unit where we put a really strong emphasis on our ability to engage others. The kind of leadership that involves getting others to do what is in your common interest without them feeling like they've been coerced into doing it. You know, I see those kinds of leaders throughout the interagency, and they're invariably tremendously successful. And that's what I would like to emulate, and that's one of the things that I work with my staff on trying to accomplish. We don't really care who in the U.S. government takes the credit for a particular initiative, but to the degree that we can have kind of synergistic, comprehensive, whole-of-government approaches to these problems, we are all better off. Mm-hmm. You know, viewed from the Afghan perspective, if they have one comprehensive U.S. government approach to them as Afghans with a way forward, that's much easier for the Afghans to understand and to follow and execute than if they're getting hit from three or four or five different directions. And in the early years, to be honest, that happened on agriculture. They would get a visit from USAID and then a visit from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and then the Defense Department had some ag experts, not to mention the Germans and the Brits and the Canadians and all the other donors. And it just had to be overwhelming. So collaborative approaches not only synergize and economize our efforts, but it also protects and makes the best use of the very limited attention span that the Afghans have. You know, this is a subsistence economy. They're trying to make sure that their family will literally live through the season or live through the year. And to the degree that we cannot distract them with non-collaborative engagements, it's really, really beneficial.
So, I mean, thinking about a way forward, and how are the Afghan people being prepared to assume responsibility of projects started by USAID? How are you doing that now?
Well, we work with Afghan ministries before we start any project. So if it's an agricultural project, we work with the Minister of Agriculture, Irrigation, and Livestock, MAIL is the acronym, at the national level to make sure that this is in line with what their strategy and their vision is. And then we work with the line ministry in the district or in the province where the project is going to be to make sure they understand it and to give them a vested interest in the program, to make sure that they are, in fact, watching this program with an eye towards taking it over. Mm-hmm. In the military, we had an algorithm that's called crawl, then walk, then run. And that when you're training someone to do something, you begin doing it very rudimentary levels, and then gradually they build the capacity from crawling to walking before they get to the level of being able to run. That's the way that we do this. In a particular agricultural program, we will involve the local ministerial representatives in the early days of the program so that they begin to see what our staff are doing and just by emulation are able to pick up that skill themselves. Because remember, in the provinces and districts, a lot of these ministerial staff are illiterate. So we can't hand them a manual that says this is how you do it. It has to be a show and tell. We show them how to do it. We tell them how to do it. We watch them do it, and we correct their mistakes. And then we show them how to do it. We tell them how to do it. We watch them do it, and we correct their mistakes. And that builds this capacity out at the district rural levels. And in the meantime, my staff in Kabul, twice a year, have what we call an in-depth portfolio review. And with the relevant ministries, we go through every portfolio, every program we have, and say, this is what we're doing, this is how much we're spending, this is where we're spending it, and this is what we see it doing in the coming year. And we get the ministry's engagement and agreement that, yes, that's in keeping with what they expected as well, and yes, they are preparing to take that on. So it's a collaborative approach, building capacity where necessary and political buy-in on every program.
So staying on the future, where do you see Afghanistan and Pakistan in the next 5 years?
To be honest, in the next 5 years, I think both countries will be larger where they are now. I think it's important. I wish I could say something more optimistic than that, but I think it's important for your listeners in the Washington community in general to have realistic expectations. You know, sometimes status quo is not a bad thing. Afghanistan has just had a successful election. They'll be preparing to inaugurate a new president. That's not a bad place to start. Afghanistan has got thousands of young Afghans graduating from Afghan VOTEC training institutions and Afghan colleges. That's not a bad place to start. You know, in Pakistan, the new government as of last June is making some really hard decisions with respect to short-term pain for long-term economic stability. So far, they're complying with the Interagency Monetary Fund's requirements for the country. That's not a bad place to be for the government of Pakistan. In both countries, I think what they need to focus on, and I don't want to sound paternalistic because Americans and foreigners too often do that in these countries, they know what the obstacles to their successful progress are, and they need to work with us to help use our resources and their indigenous knowledge and expertise to address those obstacles, whether it's WTO accession in Afghanistan, whether it's real or perceived barriers to trade and customs, or in Pakistan, untangling these technical and bureaucratic losses in their electrical energy field, improving the quality of education and access to health care. You know, both countries have a lot to do, and I think 5 years from now, they'll be focused on the same problems, but hopefully they'll be a little further along so that they can look at the next 5 years or the next 10 years after that as a point in the curve where the slope of the curve increases a bit more than it has perhaps in the past 5 years.
Larry, you mentioned the Afghani election, the recent election. What are your thoughts and main takeaways about this momentous occasion?
On that Saturday evening, Afghanistan is 9.5 hours ahead of us. So on that Friday night, when we went to bed in Washington, those of us with an interest in these elections were checking our BlackBerries and our Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds obsessively looking for the early reports. 7 o'clock in the morning is when the polls opened in Kabul and in Afghanistan. And we were eager to see how it was received. Were there security incidents? How bad were they? Were voters turning out? It was, as I recall, that day Kabul and the population centers of Afghanistan were under rains. It was not torrential rains, but that kind of spring, you know, mud just drenching rains. How would that affect turnout? My recollection is of tremendously high turnout. This was the third election they've had since 2001. It was the highest turnout of all. 7 million roughly in the first election in 2004, about half that in 2009, and estimates are 7.5 million turned out for this election. My recollections are tremendous women participation. And in fact, one of the high points for me is that an organization for the empowerment of women in Afghanistan wrote an open letter to the Minister of Interior thanking him for the work that the Afghan National Security Forces had done to make sure that women could vote. That was everything from going out of their way to recruit women searchers, to search women at the polling places, but also making sure that in general there was an area security, an aura of security that allowed women to come out and vote. That was phenomenal. It was unprecedented in Afghanistan. And it's the kind of thing that I don't think can be rolled back. So, you know, we'll be waiting to see how the new government is installed, to see how the new president and his government stand themselves up and organize themselves. Again, our expectations should be moderated. I've lived through a couple of transitions in Washington where things don't always go particularly smoothly from one administration to the other, and they certainly won't go smoothly or quickly in Afghanistan. But we need to be there steadfastly and appropriately ready to help the Afghans as they seat their new government. Mm-hmm. The pronouns are important here. We're in a supporting role. It is their government to stand up.
So as you reflect on your career in public service, what advice would you give someone who's considering such a career?
My entree into the senior executive service and public service was very abnormal. I mean, I came up through the special forces community in the Army, and at a particular point in Bosnia, was invited to step across and work for a civilian organization. It was the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And I discovered then that the military skills I had built were very valuable operationally to the OSCE, and that working in the civilian community allowed me to expand my sphere of influence and my ability to make change in the world quite a bit more than I had been able to do in the military. The other point that I'll make is I think a lot of us well, in fact, I'm fairly certain most of us don't reach what I would call a point of career maturity when we graduate from university. That degree in political science or in advertising doesn't limit you to a life of political science or advertising. Again, my degrees from Georgia Tech were applied physics and studies in electrical engineering. And those skills, the thinking processes I learned there have been invaluable to me. But I would say, you know, don't be bound by what you've done in the past. Keep your eyes open for things that resonate with you. I mean, I wish I could describe the feeling I had when I was invited to work at the OSCE in Bosnia, but it was just a sense of this feels right. It wasn't that the previous things had felt wrong, but there was kind of a, wow, this is a neat opportunity. I'm going to do this. And I think for those of us who follow our passion into community service and government service, the passion stays. It breaks my heart to hear public perceptions of government employees as kind of mindless drones who punch in at 9:01 every morning and then pull the Fred Flintstone and slip out the door at 4:59 every afternoon. That couldn't be further from the truth of the people that I work with at USAID and the State Department. So I think you have to be able to be passionate about it. And I guess one other thing I would add is I've been non-traditional. Mm-hmm. Be willing, when you lose the passion, to say, I need to step out and step out of government service and go back to the private sector, find something that you are passionate about doing. And odds are, like it has with me and countless of my friends, at some point your passion will lead you back again to government service, because it really is a good way to use an individual's skills in concert with lots of other passionate individuals to change the world. That sounds a little hokey, but that kind of, I think, is what we do at USAID.
Well, Larry, I want to thank you for coming in today, and this was a wonderful conversation. But more importantly, I'd like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Thank you. If I were to have a last thought for you and for the show, it would be to pause and think about the Americans that are deployed all over the world, not just Afghanistan and Pakistan, but your sons and daughters, cousins, school teachers, constituents. We have an incredible force of Americans, foreign service and civil servants alike, and our implementing partners who are in this moment all over the world doing things that both advance our national security agenda, but also just make the world a better place for people to live. And I think it's a good thing to get up in the morning and think about them.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Larry Sampler, Assistant to the Administrator and Director of the Office of Afghanistan and Pakistan Affairs within USAID. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.